Now, last time I tried to introduce Hegel to you and give you some general ideas about what you should look for, what the problems are, and how the difficulty in reading Hegel might perhaps be overcome, at least in part, if you ask yourself what sort of longings and hang-ups he addressed himself to, so that he became so popular for people like Marx and the young Hegelians and that whole young generation of 1840 that I talked about last time. You must also remember that with Hegel, what is primary is always the human mind. This is what we call German idealism. Would be true for Herder with his idea of spontaneity. It's true of Fichte as well. And what that means is looking at the external world from inside out, from you outwards, rather than taking, as let us say, a historical materialism does, the world and projecting the world upon you. A lot depends, everything depends, of what you make of the world. So it is an idealistic idea. It depends on people's perceptions and not, as it were, on projecting upon people's perceptions the social and economic realities. As you will see in a minute, the important thing are always your perception. The mind interacts with objective reality. And let's use the term of Karl Marx, objective reality. The mind interacts with objective reality, but in the last resort, objective reality comes through your mind. It comes through your mind. It passes through your mind. Now, oddly enough, and it is typical of the fact that this idealism never came to England or America, really, there is no word for this passage through your mind, which is so important in Hegel, and which has one German word for it, verarbeiten. But there is no English word, except one that was sort of invented, and that is the word called reification. And what reification means is that the outside world passes through your mind and is transformed in your mind. That there is an interaction between your mind and the outward world in which both are really equal halves, as you will see. But in the last resort, the outward world is transformed in your mind, which doesn't mean it's changed, and that'll be very difficult for you to understand, I think. It doesn't mean necessarily the outward world is changed immediately. Not at all, but rather you transform the outward world in your mind, and by doing so, you get ready to push it one step further towards freedom. You get ready, you get more in readiness to perform the proper action, as we shall see in a minute. Now, all of this said, the primacy of the mind emphasized, as I think we must, we can get into the detail of the system by taking the two emphases which confront you directly in your reading, reason and history. Now, what is history for Hegel, the man who became enthusiastic about the French Revolution? History is obviously the development of human freedom. And what then is human freedom? If history is the development of human freedom, what is it that develops? What is this human freedom? It is really the consciousness of freedom by man. The awareness that as an individual, as Hegel puts it, He appropriates the things that belong to him. Freedom, therefore, in Hegel is part of appropriation. It is the freedom to appropriate, the freedom to take. But it is the freedom to take those things that belong to the individual, that have been alienated from the individual by the wrong course of history. As Hegel puts it on page 23 of your reading, freedom makes man independent. That is to say, as man annexes all the things that have been alienated from him, man becomes himself. He becomes independent. As Hegel writes in page 23, "For when I am dependent, I refer myself to something else which I am not. I cannot exist independently of something external. I am free when I am within myself." In other words, there must be an end to dependence. You must control your own destiny. That is certainly a part of it, although you can never do it entirely, as you will see. You must interact with history, control your own destiny in a sense. But above all, you must grasp your whole personality. That is to say, you must become a whole person again. You must become a whole person again. For on page 23, you will read as well, following this abstract definition, it may be said that world history is the exhibition of the spirit striving to attain knowledge of its own nature. That is, your spirit, your mind, your brain must attain knowledge of your own nature, must grow in your own self-consciousness. For Hegel, that means an end of alienation, an end of the partition of man. Let me put it perhaps again in a concrete example. As long as there is the division of labor, as long as you spend all your day washing dishes or baking bread, your whole mind is concentrated on this process, baking bread or washing dishes. You don't see anything in totality. You only see a little bit of totality, the bit in which you are engrossed. Your mind is alienated from yourself because you yourself are more than Danny baking bread or somebody else washing dishes. You're obviously more than that. You are a person. You are a totality. But you can only become this totality if you end the division of labor. If you can rise in your mind above the division of labor and look at yourself as you are, as a total person, and not only that, but look at yourself in history, at yourself as a total person in history, as you will see, as a total event, as determining the external event. You have to look at the totality. Underlying Hegel's concept of man, therefore, is a certain individualism. And together with it, a new term comes into the vocabulary, the term alienation. But alienation means externalization. Externalization. That is to say, again, to get my example, you wash dishes all day, you bake bread all day, you externalize yourself. You externalize yourself. You don't see anything whole. Your attention is focused on a very segmented thing, on a very segmented activity, fragmented activity. You are alienated. You are alienated. And what does Hegel mean again? When Danny bakes bread or the rest of you wash dishes, what Hegel says in effect is you are transferring part of your individuality, your creativity, to a job which is not at all creative, but totally automated, totally automatic. You are transferring, you are giving up part of your individuality to, I wouldn't say automation, but to automatic activity. And because you are giving up part of your individuality, you lose the ability of seeing life whole, history whole. You are leaving, you're really becoming fragmented, in other words, alienated. Therefore, basic to Hegel is the concept, which will be so cardinal for Marx, of alienated labor. Alienated labor is, of course, connected with the Industrial Revolution. Alienated labor is labor that is compartmentalized. It is tacitly always contrasted to labor on the land. There you do everything. You plow, you milk, you hoe, you rake, you are in contact with nature. But you bake bread. All you do is an automatic activity with your hands in front of an oven. Or you wash dishes. All you do is an automatic activity with your hands on an object. So that this becomes what Marx and Hegel would call the fetishism of goods. In other words, the goods become your fetish, the bread, the plate. You concentrate on that, and your mind, your spirit, becomes alienated from itself. Alienated from itself. You become fetishize what in this alienated labor. Now, obviously, what you will see here again, and that will make it easier for you, is Hegel's wedding to the idea of organic unity. Really, history and the mind are one organic unity, and they must intersect as an organic unity. But alienated labor obviously breaks the organic unity, breaks the organic unity, alienates you, as it were, from the totality. It externalizes everything. But yet, of course, there is an external, and it is all important. There is the progress of history. There is economic development. There is social development. There is the French Revolution at Napoleon. There are all of the externals. There is the need of you to earn your living. There are all the externals. There are all the externals. And now I come to the crux of Hegel. How then do you deal with the external world? How do you deal with this external world without becoming alienated? Without becoming alienated. Which means, of course, you have to change the external world eventually, as you will see. But how do you deal with the external world? How do you know how to change the external world without becoming alienated? For obviously, if you are alienated through the division of labor, if you bake bread or wash dishes, to use my example, you don't see the totality anymore. You are fragmented. You won't know how to change the world either, so that you take back what belongs to you, namely your consciousness, that you take back your mind, your consciousness, which belongs to you. You won't know it. So how do you know it? And the answer is, of course, you have to mediate reality. Now, that's another word, mediation. Reality has to be mediated, and it has to be mediated in such a way that you grasp it as a totality, that you rise above Danny's baking fetishizing of bread, or let us say somebody's fetishizing of dishes. You have to rise above that, or the fetishizing of history, or the fetishizing of economics, or the fetishizing of anything external. You have to rise above that. And the way you rise above it is through your consciousness. Through your consciousness. Your consciousness mediates. That is to say, the growth of your consciousness, the growth of your self, the growth of your consciousness, the growth of your self-consciousness, the growth of your realization that you must appropriate the things that are yours. That will eventually mediate between your consciousness and reality. It will help you to reify. It will help you to rework reality, to rework reality in your consciousness, and to rework it in such a way that you see it as a totality. Because if you do not see it as a totality, you do not know what changes you have to bring about to end alienation. Hegel's ideas, therefore, are directed in a very central way to end alienation. They are obviously a product of, on the one hand, industrialization. On the other hand, the absolute monarchy, alienation from the state, alienation from politics, the absolute monarchy, alienation from work and labor, the Industrial Revolution. So that Hegel introduces through these concerns ideas which I'm sure you've used. You use the word alienation all the time people also in Europe, at any rate, still use, young people like you, use reification. I sometimes think they don't quite know what it means, but that's neither here nor there. Reification. The idea of true as over against false consciousness becomes of extreme importance. Because true consciousness is the consciousness of reappropriation of individuality, and false consciousness is satisfied with alienation. In Hegel, there is always the idea of progress, always central progress to freedom. Now, as far as I've gone now, I have tried to define for you what Hegel meant by freedom. It isn't simply political freedom or economic freedom. It's something much more complex than political and economic freedom. It is really the consciousness of freedom, which is a consciousness of totality, of the totality of life, which is a prerequisite to change, to an end of alienation. For an end of alienation is again the basic prerequisite to freedom. Now, I think you have to look at it this way. Now, where then does reason come in? Where then does reason come in? I have said we must talk about reason and history. Now, Hegel believed that reason comes in here. This seems, as your reading will make quite clear, I think, to Hegel, a growth of reason. He's still enough, he combines the Enlightenment and Romanticism, as I've told you. The Romantic is the organic. Alienation, the fetishization of goods, breaks the organic. It makes you, to use a famous Hegelian expression, a one-dimensional man. Marcuse took his title from Hegel, a one-dimensional man. Perhaps that makes it still clear. If I say that Danny baking bread or the people who wash the dishes in the union are one-dimensional men and women, one-dimensional men and women, because they have to end this alienation and they have to end their one-dimensionality. Which is another way of saying is that they're alienated, they haven't appropriated what is theirs, namely their whole personality, including, of course, their reason. But it's always a mixture, as you will see as I go on, between rationalism and the organic. Because in the end, your self-consciousness has to develop enough to change the world in what Hegel thought in accordance with reason. To change the world in accordance to what Hegel thought in accordance to reason. As we shall see, in accordance to what we shall deal on Friday, in accordance to the dialectic, but the dialectic is really in accordance to reason. Now, the difficulty that you will face reading Hegel is very simple in one way. To Hegel, then, the real is not what exists. Because you're all brought up to believe that the real is what exists. Yeah? Real is when you now punch your neighbor. That's real. You're touching a piece of flesh. But for Hegel, the mind was the only reality. You can say this is romanticism. This is idealism. This is perception. The mind is the only reality. Therefore, everything that happens must somehow be brought in relationship to your mind. And therefore, revolution. There cannot be a revolution without a preparation in your mind. Marx will agree, Engels and Lenin will not. But there has to be something in your mind first, yes? And what has to be in your mind is true consciousness. True consciousness, which means you will have to have appropriated a total personality. You will have to see things in totality. Again, this reaching out for totality. Or to put it in more philosophical terms, what is real is not which exists, but what is real is what exists in conformity with men's comprehension of it. Because what you comprehend as real is real. In a sense, real is not necessarily what exists, it's what you make of it, if you like. Or to put it another way, rationalism, as shared by Hegel and Marx, means what? It means that cognition gives access to truth, not immediate experience, like touching this or touching your neighbor or what. It gives access to truth, but the process of cognition gives access to truth, the process of comprehension. And that process of cognition depends on an end to alienation, or at least on a progressive end to alienation. The true process of cognition can only be realized if you see things, yourself and your world, as a totality. Totality. The mind, then, is always central here. We mustn't forget that. Now, what about history? What about history, then? History for Hegel is, of course, partly the history of the mind, the history of self-consciousness, the history of the development of self-consciousness through the ages. As you will see, the history of the development of self-consciousness, that is the history. The history is the history of perceptions more than anything else. That is also clear. For Hegel, it is the mind which unfolds through histories and civilization. That'll be different than Marx. For Marx, it is no longer the history of the mind, but it is the history of man's action in subduing nature, for Marx. For Marx, it is then centered to action. That was one problem, and perhaps that'll aid your understanding, that that new generation of 1840s had with its master Hegel. Hegel, for them, was not enough action-oriented. And they wanted action. They wanted to overthrow society. They wanted to act. Hegel is not oriented through action, through immediate action. And so Marx infused Hegel with an activism, as you will see, especially changed the Hegelian dialectic to an activism that isn't in the master. The master was not so interested in action. He was interested in development. He was interested in development, in process. Hegel's idea is process, not action. The process, the evolution, the organic. Marx was not a romantic. He didn't have an idea of organic anymore. He could divorce action from the organic, and he did. And so action becomes revolution. But Hegel was far from revolution. He was an organic. History is a process. And that Marx or that young generation couldn't stomach, because they wanted, that's all young people wanted, action, 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 action. That you must remember that. These were not yet your generation, whose urge to action is taken up by law school or medical school. That didn't exist yet. Yes? They still wanted an urge to action, obviously. Now, what you have, therefore, it is the mind which develops. History, however, neither in Hegel or Marx is deified. History is not something in and of itself. History is not independent of people's perception. That development will only come with Engels, and it will only come with Darwinism at the end of the century, and Darwin influencing Engels. So only after Marx, even in Marxism, you will get the idea, and I quote from Engels' tract, The Holy Family, history like truth becomes a person apart, a metaphysical subject of which the individuals are bearers. For neither Hegel or Marx does history weigh down the individual. For neither Hegel or Marx are individuals mere tools of history. That comes only later with Darwinism, with Engels, with Lenin and Bolshevism. It's not in Marx. The human mind is important. Human action is important. Human perception is important. But as later on Darwinism approaches, of course, history for Engels already becomes something self and independent, a determinism. Neither Hegel nor Marx were historical determinists. They certainly weren't economic determinists. That comes later. That comes with Darwin's influence on Friedrich Engels, and not on Marx. Engels is the father of Bolshevism, not Marx. Engels is the father of social democracy, not Karl Marx. He was much too much a Hegelian for that. He lived before Darwin, not during Darwin or after Darwin's time. And it is Darwin and Darwinism, as you will see, which will make all the difference. So there is here no determinism. Now, what then about history? What then about history? History does exist, it does evolve, and man cannot ignore history. And history is made by forces which man cannot control. Many forces of history are beyond your control. Hegel could not control the French Revolution. So obviously there is a history separate from man in that sense. Man cannot control. And that is what Hegel means in your reading by necessity. Life is a conflict between freedom and necessity. Necessity is the history over which you have no control. Freedom is the growth of your mind over which you do have control, and the comprehension of a totality, including necessity. And your whole development towards freedom is, in a way, to get rid of necessity, to get rid of necessity which hems you in. So that life, in a way, is a tension between freedom, the development of self-consciousness, and necessity, the necessity of history. Freedom, human individuality, the spirit of freedom, as Hegel put it, and as he put it very sharply. Let me just read you one passage. The nature of the spirit, he said, may be understood by a glance at its opposite, matter. As the essence of matter is gravity, so on the other hand, we may affirm that the substance of spirit is freedom. So there is a contrast, you see. It's not a determinism. It is not a fetishism of goods. Goods are material. The essence of goods, bread or dishes, is gravity. The essence of the spirit is freedom. And so you must develop your spirit, which you can only do by looking at totalities, by taking back what has been alienated. The essence is freedom, but freedom is limited by necessity. The task is really, in the last resort, to reconcile freedom and necessity. That is really the task. I don't think Hegel believed, you'll see, that you can ever abolish necessity, because you can't abolish history. History is always there. You can't really control it in many ways. But you can certainly, in a way, reconcile freedom and necessity. You can certainly come to a harmony between freedom and necessity. As Marx put it in his PhD thesis, Marx's PhD thesis on the classics, which was Karl Marx's PhD thesis, was, of course, as you can imagine, a Hegelian work, as he put it. Philosophy stands, says Karl Marx, against all gods in heaven and earth that do not recognize human self-consciousness as the highest good. That is the essence of Marx's PhD thesis. Human self-consciousness as the highest good. And human self-consciousness, the highest good, however, cannot stand alone because it must interact with history, with necessity, and there must be a harmony between the two. Now, from what I have said, I think, the title of your reading, which is Reason in History, had better be translated as follows: The Development of Human Self-Consciousness in History. Or to put it another way, the development of human self-consciousness against history. Until human self-consciousness has developed so far that there can be a harmony, a balance between history and human self-consciousness. Until there can be a balance in the progress in freedom. Until history and self-consciousness meet in freedom. Now, why can they ever meet in freedom? Why can there be a kind of harmony between human self-consciousness and freedom? Only because Hegel believed that freedom was always latent in history. That no matter what the historical development from primitive man to modernity, and no matter how it alienated man, inherent in it always was freedom as a kind of kernel of history which has to be brought out. It's always there, even if you're alienated by history, even if Danny breaking his bread is alienated by the development of history. That is to say, what has alienated him is, after all, the development of history which led to industrialism, etc., etc. There is still a kernel of freedom, always latent in history, always pushing to get out. And once Danny gets the right consciousness, once he sees things as a totality, then he can work and help to bring out freedom to such an extent that he can bake bread and yet not be alienated, to such an extent that there is a harmony between his activity and freedom, a harmony, of course, through his mind, through the mediation of his mind, always. So history is latent with possibilities. History is latent with possibilities because, after all, it is organic. And organic means continuity, but also development. History is always changing, but it is always changing in a rhythm. And part of that rhythm is, it is always changing to try and bring out freedom unrealized. As Hegel puts it on page 30 of your reading, here, already the simple instinct of living together contains the conscious purpose of securing life and property. Once this in primal society has been established, the purpose expands. But world history begins its general aim, namely to realize the idea of the spirit. And remember, freedom is the essence of the idea of the spirit. Only at first in an implicit form, as an innermost instinct. And the whole business of history, Hegel tells you on page 30, is to bring this innermost instinct into consciousness. Why is that the whole business of history? Because you can only act on your consciousness. So history must bring more and more the innermost instinct of freedom, which is there in you and in history, into consciousness, because you can only act on the basis of your consciousness. So that is the business of history. That is the essence of history, is to bring the innermost instinct of freedom, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense. You interact with history. Your conscience interacts with history. There have to be two basic presuppositions. That you and history must have something in common. Otherwise, there can never be a final harmony. And that thing you have in common is freedom. And secondly, there must be a second basic presupposition in order to bring freedom and necessity, your self-consciousness and history, into some kind of harmony. Not only the idea, as it were, of inner freedom, but also the possibility of progress. And they're both there, the possibility of progress and the inner freedom. And the thing is to bring it out. And you can only bring it out, that harmony, by an end to alienation. And alienation, he thinks of course, in totality. Now then again, perhaps I've made too vague, but totality for Hegel consists in two halves. One half is to see the world as a whole. In other words, to have historical consciousness, to see your place in history and to understand the dialectic. I'll come to that next time. To understand the dialectic. One part of the totality is to understand the dialectic, namely to understand the way history works. And then you can change it. You understand history works and you're part in it, then you can change it. You have to understand the dialectic. But to understand the dialectic, you have to see yourself and history interacting, interacting, never separate, interacting. You have to understand it that way. Yes? That's one half. But the second half is certainly property. Certainly property. Certainly Hegel is in the Lockean tradition. There can be no freedom without private property. And certainly, he believes that part of alienated labor is its industrial nature. Certainly, he also still believes in the yeoman state, as I've talked to you about a few lectures ago. Certainly, part of reappropriation is, if Danny reappropriates his acres and becomes a free man on his 3 acres, that also, certainly, he must reappropriate, you will think, what was his. That is, he must have property. There was never the idea that you can have freedom without property. Because freedom is, in the last resort, independence. Critical thought, independence. Remember that. He's also an enlightenment. Freedom is, in the last resort, critical thought and independence. And nobody thought as yet that you can be. And everybody thought, I'm sorry, as yet, that you can have independence if you have property. Remember, this is before the confiscatory taxation of today. Yes? When you think I'm paid, I'm not paid. I'm paying the state. That's all I'm doing here. I'm not earning any money. I'm just earning any money for state programs. That's all. But that was in the future. Nobody thought of that I am a public welfare institution, which I am. Nobody thought of that yet. Not at all. Not at all did they think of that. As yet, before the modern state and taxation, the idea was quite clear that if you have property, you're independent. Nobody can tell you what to do. Nobody can tell you what to do. Today, everybody tells you what you can do and not do on your property. That's the modern state, don't forget. But in Hegel's time, at the beginning of the 19th century, nobody told you yet what to do on your own property. Man in his castle, the peasant on his land, man on 3 acres. All this yeoman idea only makes sense on this. The Lockean idea that freedom and property is linked made sense in this, because it makes no sense today. But it made sense in this when you still had control over your property and your earning. And when it was thought of as anti-industrial to a very large extent, as I told you, even Marx did that with hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon. Marx, for his utopia, always uses anti-industrial terminology, hunting and fishing. He doesn't say to go down Oxford Street in the morning, you see, and to go to the theater in the afternoon. That would be the urban view, not Marx's view, not Hegel's view, because of this idea of property that I've tried to make clear to you. Now, there is nothing, then, in a way which doesn't immediately express itself in reality. Now, history, however, has its own rhythm, to be sure. And Hegel's whole effort you can look at, and you must now look at from a slightly changed perspective, namely to integrate the flux and chaos of history into his system, to control history. For as I told you once before, the idea is always, why are these all historical theories? Because history is one way to control a puzzling and rapidly changing reality. So Hegel wants to control history and to integrate it into its system, this flux and change of history. Obviously, men very often produce results in history which are quite different as they intended. Hegel looked at Napoleon, and he said Napoleon was a champion of freedom, but he became a champion of oppression. Men in history often produce quite different results than they intended. In world history, the actions of men produce results quite different from their purpose. That to him was obvious and very troubling, very, very troubling. Because it means a loss of control, if that is so. A loss of control, if that is so, that men produce different results. A loss of control that he had somehow to cope with, this kind of loss of control. And so he said as follows. Even if Napoleon produced something he didn't want to produce, this he called the cunning of reason. Because men like Napoleon are the instruments of history for progress. So even though it does not seem as there's any progress, even though men are the playthings of history, in reality, they are integrated into that progress. The inquiry into the essential destiny of reason is identical with the question, what is the ultimate design of the world? And the ultimate design of the world is the harmony between freedom and necessity. And to a certain extent, he had to admit, and you will read it again in what you read, that men are the playthings of history, that especially of great men, are the tools of what he called the cunning of reason. But it is the cunning of reason. It is cunning because though Napoleon is a tool of oppression, nevertheless, he furthers the dialectic. And so in the last resort, Hegel has to posit a paradox at the essence of the working of history. A paradox, namely that oppression leads to freedom, as in Napoleon, that even those things which are unfreedom, in the end are integrated into a rhythm of freedom, if I can put it that way, and a growth of human self-consciousness. That as you will read, especially world historical figures who move and shape history, as he thought, like Napoleon or Caesar, yes? These are the tools of the cunning of reason. They do not know what they do, but history knows what they do. But they don't know what they do because they are integrated into an ultimate aim. An ultimate aim which you can understand eventually with the growth of your self-consciousness. Not Napoleon, not Caesar could understand it, but you have a hope of understanding it. To be more than just the tools of history. To be more than the tools of history. To live in harmony with history. Perhaps I can put it that way. To live in harmony of history as two things come together. The development and the progress of history upwards towards freedom and the progress of your own self-consciousness towards freedom. As to those two things more and more are in a trajectory to come into harmony, more and more you will not be merely the tools of history, but you can also help shape history. You can do what is, after all, the essence of Marx and Hegel and all of these theories, namely, you can integrate yourself with history. You can integrate yourself with history. And it no longer becomes frightening, but it becomes hope. You no longer have lost, to use your own terminology, control over your own destiny. Because alienation for Hegel also is not only fragmentation, it is having lost control over your own destiny. And what you're reading, Reason in History, is a text on how to get back that control, in which Marx and that generation of 1840 deeply believed, because they also believed that they had lost control over their own destiny. Now the crux is, what do you understand? And in order to answer that, Hegel has to be specific, the way history works. You understand the way history works. History is not chaos, because if history were chaos, there would be nothing for you to integrate yourself with. Remember, this is a doctrine based upon reason, your mind, your understanding. And therefore, history can't be chaos. History works a certain way. And the way history works is the way of the dialectic. The dialectic, the rhythm of history, is what you integrate yourself with. So as you rise to a greater understanding, as you take back what has been alienated from you, your mind and your property, as you take it back from modern society, and as at the same time history progresses, ever more and more towards freedom. As these two things come together, you get eventually, through understanding the dialectic, into a harmony and a balance, which will integrate you with history, which will integrate you in a mutual relationship. For avoid one thing when you deal with Hegel, of tearing apart what he tried to join. You always want to live in an either-or world. This is the opposite of the either-or world. Things are joined. The end is a process of integration, not a process of separation. things are integrated, not joined. And that may be an insection. Maybe you should hit this especially hard. That, and it's because it's especially difficult for you to grasp. That there is a constant interaction between separate entities, you and history. Separate entities which are not separate at all. For in the end, everything is always a paradox. Everything comes back to a paradox, the paradox of life, in a sense, and the solving of that paradox. And nothing is more difficult for young people than to think of life as a paradox, because you want solutions. You want final solutions. And I always say the success of this course will be judged partly, at any rate, whether you leave this course knowing that most problems are insoluble, which is, of course, true. And more blood has been shed because people wanted solutions than anything else. There are no solutions for most things. They are insoluble. Grow up in your consciousness. Get through consciousness. And I'll come to the dialectic next time.